Matt Hoy in here today for Dave Congleton, who is out probably solving world peace or something like that. We are going to be talking this hour with Anthony Watts of the website What's Up With That. He is a probably the proprietor of the most well-read and famous kind of climate skeptic website out there. Anthony, we got you?
We do.
Okay.
I'm right here.
Well, let's get this out of the way first, because last time I was guest hosting here, I try and bring a little balance to what Dave usually has on here, which is kind of your typical climate scientist. And the question I got last time I had Dr. Roy Spencer on that he got from somebody later in the program was this, and I just want to get this out of the way. How much money have you received from Big Oil?
Well, that is a big fat double zero.
Okay.
Not one penny. And it's the most common myth that people that are skeptical of climate change and climate change science are, they must be funded by the oil companies because they can't, you know, they can't come up with these opinions on their own. No, that's not true. I've never received a penny from any oil or any kind of energy company of any sort to have any opinion. And it's just a fabrication that these folks use in order to make people look bad.
So explain to our listeners kind of what your background is, as far as I understand you used to be a meteorologist, and how you kind of came up with the What's Up With That website and how that all formed.
Okay, well, I spent about 25 years on the air as a television meteorologist, and during that time I had a secondary career as an engineer running a company providing weather services for television stations, and I was involved in some of the early things that made television weather what it is today, supplying hardware to companies like AccuWeather, to allow them to get their television weathercast on TV. I had come up with the first broadcast interface for the IBM PC back in the early 80s, and this allowed, back then, by today's standards, crude computer graphics to be broadcast on the air. And it sounds like a simple thing today, but back then it was really quite a challenge because it hadn't been done before. Computers and television didn't talk to one another. And so I had this dual career where I was on the air at WLFI-TV in Lafayette, Indiana, and then I ended up going to California to KHSL-TV in Chico, California. And I had this company that I ran during the day, and I tested a lot of my new designs and so forth on the air and provided them to, you know, to other weather companies like AccuWeather, WSI, and so forth. The Weather Channel had some of my early hardware, and so that's my background. And then in 2002, I left television to concentrate on the business and family and so forth. And in 2006, I started What's Up With That with the local newspaper, which originally started out to be a pure science site, where we were talking about all kinds of different interesting things in science. But at that year, Al Gore had put out his Inconvenient Truth movie, and I got a lot of questions about that, and so it kind of steered that way. And from that point on, it became mainly climate-focused and continues to be so today.
So you've been doing that for about 10, 12 years, it sounds like.
And, that's right.
And what is how many people are visiting your site on a daily basis?
Typically, on an average day, we get about 100,000 views on the website.
And there's a lot of local newspapers and whatnot who would kill for that kind of number of visits. So,
yeah, it's funny because my views on the blog actually exceed the views of the local newspaper.
So you've been doing this for about 10 years. When I had Roy Spencer on, he described himself as a lukewarmist.
Mm-hmm.
Just what is kind of your position on climate change? It seems like when someone identifies as a so-called climate skeptic, or as the other side calls them, a climate denier, that a lot of things are kind of tossed in there in that same pot that that isn't necessarily true, frankly, for most climate skeptics. You don't believe in science. You don't believe climate ever changes, that sort of thing. So kind of, if you can kind of outline your views for us.
Well, yeah, we get a lot of that kind of rhetoric that gets thrown at us. You know, we've gotten everything from the flat earthers to, you know, science deniers and science haters and all that sort of stuff. I love science. Science has helped humanity advance and become what it is today. And so, no, I'm not a science hater. And climate has changed for millions of years. It always has, and it always will. And so I don't deny that climate has changed and will change. And further, yes, man has had an effect on climate. There have been a number of different effects that man has had. And what's missing from a lot of the arguments out there is that they don't look at the positive effects that man has had on the climate and the earth. There are some, but they don't get any press because, you know, there was an old saying when I was in television news that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, you know, things that you'd never see a headline, for example, in television news. And live from the Weather Center, nice weather today. You know, they don't go for that. They want to hear storms, tornadoes, that sort of thing, damage, hysteria. There's lots of that kind of stuff in news. If it bleeds, it leads. So the climate change folks are also in that sort of same thinking process. They go for scary stories that motivate people. And my viewpoint is that, yeah, we've had some effect. Several things have happened. There is a natural cycle to things. It does get warmer, it does get colder due to natural cycles of the ocean and the atmosphere. Those don't get talked about very much, but they're there. There are also cycles related to the sun, and those affect Earth's climate. There's cycles related to the ocean, the changes of things like algae in the ocean, something called albedo, the reflectivity of the ocean, sometimes changes based on the amount of plankton and algae in the ocean, and therefore the ocean will absorb more sunlight when the ocean is darker versus when it's not. Same thing happens with El Nino. El Nino, when it happens during mostly the wintertime, that's why it's named the boy in terms of the Christ child, because it typically happens in December when it peaks, it's an effect of the change of winds from South America all the way over towards Indonesia. The trade winds change direction and they change intensity and so forth, and that changes the surface roughness of the water, which changes the way it looks from space, darker versus lighter. And so it absorbs more heat from the sun. That's one part of it. There's a change in water upwelling and so forth. That's all part of a natural cycle. And then there's carbon dioxide that has been turned into this big villain. And yes, we have increased the carbon dioxide levels over the last 100 years on the planet. Right now, we're up around 410 parts per million, and there are people who say that we're way above a safe value. Dr. James Hansen, who used to run NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, said that the safe level was at 350 parts per million, which hasn't been around since the mid-80s. So there's this fear that carbon dioxide is going to cause excessive heating of the atmosphere, and therefore is going to cause all kinds of havoc in the atmospheric system. And then there's another factor that people don't pay a lot of attention to, and that is urbanization, the so-called urban heat island. And most anyone who's ever ridden a bicycle or a motorcycle can attest to this. As you're going down the road, you come into cold pockets and warm pockets of air. And you will notice that sometimes, you know, when you're in a grassy area, it's a little cooler. And when you're driving by a bunch of parking lots, it's warmer. Everyone knows that it's warmer in the parking lot than it is on a grassy area. And so with man's increase of infrastructure, we've added more heat-absorbing infrastructure that affects where temperature is measured. And that's a factor. So I don't deny anything. I look at all the different pieces and say, can we really pin it on one of those? carbon dioxide as being the total cause. And I say, no, it's a factor, but it's not the total cause.
We're here with Anthony Watts on the Dave Congleton Show, 920 KVEC AM. If you'd like to call in and ask Mr. Watts a question or just have any questions about climate science, please give us a call. Number is 543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. We'll be right back here on KVEC News Talk 920 AM.
Grab the road. I've got seats that selflessly hold my friends and a trunk that can carry the heaviest of loads.
This is Matt Hoy, guest hosting for Dave Congleton on the Dave Congleton Show, News Talk 920 KVEC, 96.5 FM. We're on the radio here with Anthony Watts of the website Watts Up With That, WATTSUpWithThat.com. And Anthony, you're talking about urban heat islands and carbon dioxide. One of the first, to my knowledge, it was probably one of the first examples of kind of crowdsourcing science was your surface stations project that you were running back there in the almost a decade ago. Can you tell our listeners what that was and what you found out?
Well, that was a piece of serendipity, stumbled on by accident. And sometimes some of the best discoveries in science are from serendipity. You look at something that surprises you and you go, that's not supposed to happen that way. And then you realize you're onto something. So that's kind of how the surface stations project got started. It had to do with the fact that the former climatologist of California, the state climatologist of California, retired to my town, Chico, California, and we became friends. And he started showing me some pictures of some of the weather stations that he'd taken around California. And this was in the mid-90s. When he started showing me these pictures. Anyway, he had shown me a picture of the weather station at the Mount Hamilton Observatory, which is east of San Jose. And this is the place where science is practiced daily. And there's, you know, a big cadre of scientists up there. They had a weather station up there that was part of the Cooperative Observer Network operated by the National Weather Service. And this weather station happened to be on the roof of a sort of a parking facility that they had. And that's one issue because, you know, underneath it was concrete, and during the day, sunlight would be absorbed into the concrete, and then at night it would release that energy as heat, and that would bias upward the overnight temperature. It would be warmer than it normally would be because of that heat release from the concrete. But that was not the biggest scientific problem with measuring temperature there. The weather station was right next to their incinerator for garbage. And I looked at this and I said, you know, really? This is where the scientists hang out and they're doing this stuff? And then he showed me another one from Caltrans in Quincy, California, up in the mountains, Sierra Nevada. And it was also next to an incinerator. And at the time, I thought these were just, you know, funny. And I didn't take a whole lot of stock in it at that time, but just a couple of, you know, strange things. But once I started my blog doing general science, I had remembered those things, and I wanted to look into that further. But I also had an idea about something that happened to me when I went to Purdue University. I worked for the meteorology department as a student doing technological things for them. And one of the things I had to do was to set up a weather station for the very first time. They assigned a plot of land to put a meteorological facility in, and I was in charge of putting that together. And they ordered something called a Stevenson screen. And this has been the way that temperature was measured all the way back to 1890, when the Weather Service, the Weather Bureau back then, was formed. And they started producing these little things called Stevenson screens, which looked like chicken coops on four legs, wooden legs. And they had had slats so that air could flow through each side, and a door that opened. And inside was a thermometer that two types of thermometers, a mercury thermometer and then an alcohol thermometer. And the alcohol thermometer had these little pins in it, magnetic pins, that measured the highs and the lows. And then the mercury thermometer measured the current temperature. And observations were taken from these all around the United States. And that was then copied and used around the world. And these Stevenson screens, when they put them in 1890, were coated with whitewash from the Tom Sawyer days. They didn't have latex paint back then. So whitewash was the covering of choice to make them white and reflective so they didn't absorb a lot of heat from sunlight. Well, the problem with whitewash is that it rubs off and wears off very quickly, and if you don't repaint it, it tends to expose the wood, and then the wood is brown, and that absorbs more sunlight, and temperature goes up, and so forth, and so on. And so these things were a lot of maintenance, and I remember unpacking one of these things at the university, and this whitewash was coming off in my hands, and I said to the professor, hey, what is this stuff? He explained the whole whitewash thing and why, and it's been a standard. This was in 1975, and so I said, okay, but that always stuck with me, and I wondered if they'd ever changed the paint, because I remembered seeing one at the local agriculture facility here, and in fact, they changed.
Anthony, got about a minute left.
Say again?
You got about a minute left, so.
Okay, yeah, they changed the paint to latex. So the point is, I started looking at weather stations around the United States and found that not only had they switched to latex, but changed the characteristics of measuring temperature, but a lot of these weather stations had been encroached upon by parking lots, air conditioners, so forth and so on. And that had a major effect on the temperature. And I published a study at the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco in 2016 that showed this. Clearly, that there was a bias in temperature associated with the way that thermometers were encroached upon over the last 100 years. And that is a big component of our global warming signal.
And
that's something that hasn't been paid attention to.
We'll touch on that a little bit more after this break. Again, this is Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave Congleton on the Dave Congleton Show, 920 KVEC. We're here with Anthony Watts. You got a question, give us a call, 543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. This is News Talk 920 KVEC, the Dave Congleton Show. Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave Congleton. We've got Anthony Watts of What's Up With That. If you would like to ask him a question or had a comment, please feel free to give us a call, 543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. So, Anthony, this paper that you ended up presenting out of the Surface Stations project, The worst case of scenarios, were thermometers next to incinerators and air conditioning units on roofs. What percentage of the thermometers nationwide were that bad?
Well, we grouped them by severity, categories 1 through 5, with 5 being the worst and 1 being the best. And category 1 and 2 were considered okay for measuring climate. And this was done by another researcher, and this had been accepted by the meteorological and climate community, his standards. This was a fellow by the name of Michael Leroy from Meteo France. He had accepted, he had published on this paper in 2010, and basically defined the parameters that made a weather station suitable for measuring climate. And so what we found was that throughout the United States, 90% of the weather stations used for measuring climate by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration were compromised, and they were category 3, 4, and 5. Some of them were literally in parking lots. The University of Arizona at the Atmospheric Sciences Department, where you think they would know better, had their primary weather station that had been measuring temperature since 1857 in the parking lot in front of the University Atmospheric Sciences building. And, you know, you look at that and you think, these are scientists. How could they do this? And that problem had to do with bureaucracy. The University of Arizona at Tucson kept growing, and the weather station was a low-priority thing, and they kept moving it. The administration said, you've got to move that. We're going to put a new building in there. And so what happened is that they ran out of places to put it, and they put it in the parking lot. They wanted to continue the record, but by that point, the record had been corrupted because, you know, measuring the temperature of the parking lot is not measuring the temperature of the climate of the Earth. And so once we found that and published on it, the thing got shut down within about a month. Of course, nobody told us they shut it down. They were too embarrassed. But that's the kind of things that we found. And so the problem is that in the United States, the global warming signal that they use and they publish, about half of that signal is attributed to the problems with these stations.
What does that mean, or how does that translate into, you know, we hear, it seems like every year that this was the hottest year on record. How did that contribute to that kind of record in any way, or?
Absolutely it does. This slow change that we've had in our infrastructure around the United States has caused more concrete, more asphalt, more buildings to be built. I mean, you think about, you know, if you're over 50 years old, what it was like 50 years ago and what it's like today, you know, in terms of things being built up around your town. And there's been a lot of infrastructure added. So what's happened is that all of the global warming signal, almost all of it, is in the overnight temperature where, and anyone who stood next to a building that's been in the sun during the day, stood next to it at night, can attest to this. You can feel the heat radiating off the side of the building, you know, and that's what happens. These thermometers, they stay in one place because they want to maintain a record from one location, but stuff gets built up around them, and that stuff, roads, asphalt, concrete, sidewalks, buildings, and so forth, pick up the solar energy during the day and re-radiate it as heat at night, and that brings up the minimum temperature overnight, the lowest temperature measured overnight. The way they calculate global warming has to do with taking the high and low temperature from every weather station in the United States every day, averaging it to get a daily average, and then getting a monthly average and a yearly average from that. So if you bring up the low temperature, that's going to bias the average temperature, and it is the average temperature which has been touted as the one increasing over the last 100 years. But in reality, it's really mostly all in the low temperature. We don't see the same kind of thing happening in the high temperature. A perfect example is Las Vegas. I've got on my website the graphs of temperature provided by the Weather Service in Las Vegas, and they clearly show how all that stuff that they've built up and turning the strip into the monstrosity that it is has affected the temperature measured at the McCarran National Airport, International Airport there. That's where they've been measuring temperature. To give you an idea of how this encroachment happens and kind of visualize it, let me ask you a question. Have you ever been to Chicago O'Hare Airport?
I have not.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people fly through there, and it's one of the busiest airports in the world. It has a ticket for your luggage, if that's your destination, that says ORD. That is the airport identifier, ORD. A lot of people think that stands for O'Hare, but it does not. It stands for what the airport originally was named, Orchard Field. And literally, when aviation was first starting, most of the aviation was in grass fields. And that's how it was back then, Orchard Field. They measure the temperature and the wind and all that stuff because aviation needs it. And so what happened is when people started thinking global warming was happening, they co-opted all of these weather stations at airports to put into the climate record, thinking we'll use these long aviation records to see what's happening with the climate. Well, as you know,
lots of asphalt.
Orchard Field's no longer a a grassy field. It's a big metroplex of concrete and asphalt. Mm-hmm. And so the temperature there goes up dramatically, overnight especially. And that's part of why there's a huge global warming signal from all this infrastructure.
We got a caller with a question. Go ahead, state your name, where you're from, and ask a question for Anthony.
All right, Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you, Fonten.
Go ahead, ask a question.
Oh,
with
sorry, go ahead.
Are you familiar with the HAARP program with the antennas trying to manipulate the weather, and what are your thoughts or feelings on it?
Well, the HAARP program, first of all, got closed down several years ago. Funny thing, it got closed down by the Environmental Protection Agency because the diesel generators they were using to run the radio transmitters up there were polluting too much, and it cost too much to rebuild them and redo them, so they shut the project down. But as far as weather control, let me just tell you, that is some of the worst junk science out there. And the reason is simply magnitude of the amount of energy. This radio station bounced radio waves into the upper atmosphere, and it got this, people got this idea that somehow that was affecting our weather. Well, the amount of energy that this thing produces in comparison to the amount of energy received from the sun in the atmosphere daily is like 1/100th of 1% of the amount of energy. It's just, there's just not enough energy being produced by the HAARP thing in order to be able to affect our weather on a large scale. And so the premise that HAARP was affecting our weather is just patently ridiculous.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you. Bye now.
Another question for Anthony. Go ahead, state your name, where you're from.
And Matt, you're on the air.
This is Matt. I'm from San Luis Obispo. And I appreciate your writings. In fact, I read your some of your stuff a few years ago and looked up the San Luis Obispo County weather stations, and one is at Cal Poly University, and the other one's at the city of Paso Robles.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to look at the site.
I visited the one at the university.
Say again?
I visited the weather station at the university in San Luis Obispo there.
Yes, and I did too, and I wrote a little article about that for a local paper, including the one in Paso Robles. The Paso Robles weather station is on the busiest street in San Luis Obispo, on a concrete pad where cars back into it, or cars chase and park their cars there. And it shows, I looked at your criteria, and it's amazing how incorrect the data is based on what they're doing there. And all I got for it was a huge amount of flack for writing the paper and exposing them. They said I was not a scientist, so I couldn't talk about stuff like that, which is patently just absurd. Because it doesn't take a scientist to see where the factors are. But I appreciate very much what you've written about, and keep going. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And you're absolutely right. Yes, the thermometer in Paso Robles is right next to the highway exit for Highway 101. I have a picture of that, and it's on concrete. And there's a pump facility next to it. I think it's a sewage pumping facility or a water pumping facility. And the one that's at the college in San Luis Obispo is back by the maintenance building, and there's junk piled all around it. There's, you know, an old trailer and some pallets and things like that. And that prevents wind from reaching that thermometer, and it's important for the airflow. And so, you know, these are places where they're conducting a long-term scientific experiment, but the problem is that the people that are up at the top of the scientific food chain don't get out of their offices and look at this stuff. They assume that the data that's being produced by these thermometers is reliable and accurate, when in fact it is not.
We're here on the Dave Conklin Show, 920 KVEC. 920 AM, 96.5 FM with Anthony Watts of What's Up With That. We'll be right back. If you've got a question for Anthony, please feel free to give us a call, 543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832.
Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you kiss me once or twice, then say it's very nice and then you run.
sister, don't you do what your big sister done.
This is the Dave Congleton Show on 920 KBEC. This is Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave Congleton. We got Anthony Watts of What's Up With That here with us. Anthony, it seems to me that some of the most kind of prominent climate skeptics, for the most part, seem to be meteorologists. The late John Coleman of the Weather Channel, and I personally remember John because I grew up in San Diego, and he was always doing KUSI weather there. And you know, Joe Bastardi of Weather Bell. Is there some sort of affinity for skepticism about what climate scientists are doing for meteorologists? Why does that seem to be true?
Well, I think it's because meteorologists, and in particular television meteorologists like myself and John Coleman, if we did something wrong, if we made a forecast that was just didn't fly, we'd hear about it. There were consequences, you know. Viewers would say, you know, you didn't get it right. You botched it. And that would translate into lost ratings, and that would translate into you perhaps losing your job if you screwed it up. And so the difference between meteorology and climate science is the fact that in meteorology, you do a forecast, you know, a few days out, and if the forecast is wrong, you'll find out. It's proved, you know, in a day or two. And then you can use that information, well, I did something wrong, and then you can work on improving what you did so that you don't make the same mistake next time. And that's how the National Weather Service operates. And they've gotten quite good at forecasting out. 30, 40 years ago, you couldn't forecast out with any reliability more than about 3 or 4 days. Now, they can accurately forecast out to 7 days, sometimes as much as 10 days, and do a good job of it. But with climate science, they don't have these checks and balances. They make a prediction for the year 2050 or 2100. That's one of their favorites, 2100. It's going to be this warm by 2100. Well, there's nothing to prove or disprove that. It's a theory. We can't take a time machine into the year 2100 and find out what the temperature is. So there's no consequences to them being wrong. And as a result, they get a basic free pass in science to say these outrageous things and no proof of actually their forecast being right.
Well, to be fair, they learned their lesson, because I can remember some what I would call climate alarmists predicting that we would have an ice-free Arctic during the summer of 2015.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't recall that happening. And so, you know, at least they're learning their lesson. They're trying not to make predictions that people who are still alive today would remember. Here's a question I asked Roy Spencer. It's a question I want to kind of ask you. What would it take scientifically? What sort of evidence would be required that they would have to show you for you to say, you know what? The Earth is warming at a dangerous rate. It is going to be bad for humanity and other living things, and that we have to do something about it and throw lots of money at it right now, and there's no time to waste. What sort of evidence would they have to bring to you for you to say, yeah, you guys are right, and I'm on your side?
Well, it's funny that you ask that, because in 1988, I was actually in exactly that position. I believed exactly what you said. And the reason was, at my television station at that time, I was watching Dr. James Hansen testify before Congress in June 1988. And he was talking about the dire effects of future climate. And I believed everything he had to say because I trusted science. I trusted it implicitly back then. But I did a complete about face. And the reason is that I lost my trust in climate science. Other sciences I still have trust in, but climate science I lost trust in. And so let me give you an example. When they went to do this Senate hearing, Dr. Hansen of NASA Guest was sponsored by Senator Timothy Wirth of Colorado, and he was an activist senator. And they figured out, by talking to the Weather Bureau, what was likely to be the hottest day in June when they could do this hearing. And so they scheduled the hearing for that. And then the night before, Senator Wirth and Dr. Hansen went to the hearing room, opened up the windows, and disabled the air conditioning. So that the next day, when the hearing was happening, all of these people that were listening to Dr. Hansen talk about how hot it's going to get from global warming were sitting up there on the podium sweating. And Wirth bragged about it later in an interview on PBS Frontline, where he actually said it was bliss watching these people sweat on camera. Now, I said to myself when I first heard of this, if their science was so strong, why do they need this BS theatrics to put the point across? And that's, you know, really when I started questioning things, that and the way the surface temperature record's being measured and so forth and so on. And so today, what would it take for them to convince me that they're right? Well, I used to be convinced, but now they've got to turn me back, and it's even harder. And I would basically say they would have to do a big mea culpa and say, we were wrong about a number of things. Some of the dire predictions we made about sea ice were flat wrong, and they were oversold. And some of the predictions we made about temperature were oversold. And we made mistakes. But this is what we know today, and this is real. And I think if they did that, that would win some people back. But at this point, I don't believe that global warming is a serious threat. Yes, it's happening, but if you look at history, throughout history, humanity has always done better when it's warmer. During the medieval periods, when things were very cold, humanity suffered badly. And the big growth spurts for humanity happened when we had warmer periods. The Roman warming period was one. Pre-medieval times, it was very cold. And then we had the medieval warming period. And then we had the Little Ice Age, and then things got bad. Washington crossing the Delaware and the ice and all that stuff, you know, that didn't do good for humanity back then, but then things warmed up. And the other thing is that right now we are globally having some of the best agricultural productivity, actually not some of the best in the history of mankind. And part of it has to do with the fact that the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is helping plant life thrive. And NASA, through their satellite program, even measured this. And in the last 30 years, there has been an increase in the greening of the planet, a surface area equal to the surface area of the United States. So, is global warming bad? Maybe not. There's some good things that are happening. Agricultural productivity is up. We're getting more biomass. Trees are returning. There's good things associated with it, and humanity seems to be thriving in the warmth.
One last question. You know, getting into this, I can remember on your blog once you had a one of these climate scientists who's kind of doing what seemed like the equivalent of an Ask Me Anything that, you know, the Reddit website does. And and the question I asked him had to do with that. I said my question to him was, what caused the medieval warming period? Because it obviously wasn't SUVs that caused that.
No.
And his answer, it was very honest, and I appreciated his honesty, but I don't think he helped his case. His answer was, well, I don't know what caused the medieval warming period, but I know this time it's us, meaning humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, you know, now, you know, full disclosure here, my degree is in journalism, not science. So in that, I'm as qualified as Al Gore is. But that doesn't seem very scientific to me.
Well, the fact is that there's still lots of things we don't understand about our planet. And people that claim that they do understand the workings of the planet exactly are just simply fooling themselves and fooling you. For example, something I published last week had to do with geology and the atmosphere. And this was something that was just really kind of a shocker. That everybody knows, they've taken basic science in school, that the atmosphere is made up of about 78% nitrogen, around 21% oxygen, and then the rest of it is a mixture of other gases. Well, of that 78% nitrogen, there was this nitrogen deficit they couldn't figure out where
Anthony,
we're sourcing from.
We've got to go. We're out of time. But thank you very much. If you're looking for more from Anthony, whatsupwiththat.com, W-A-T-T-S, upwiththat.com. This is Matt Hoy on the Dave Congleton Show, 920 AM KVEC, News Talk 96.5 FM.